are listening to the Fundamentalist Podcast.
Until the light takes us, am I right, Bog?
Welcome into the Fundamentalist Podcast. I am your host, dual guest, joined as always by Richard Donahue and Peter Bog. This episode, we are once again going to take a deep dive, an under the knife, into one of our favorite artists in the world of heavy metal. This episode is going to focus on Austin Lunn, the mastermind behind United States black metal band Panopticon. Panopticon are considered to be one of the standouts of the United States black metal genre. Known for their heavy use of American folk instruments and Austin Lunn's staunch support for ecological and labor-minded anarchist political views, Panopticon was formed in 2007 and their self-titled debut album was released in 2008. To critical acclaim. The band has released 9 albums, including landmark recordings such as Kentucky in 2012 and Autumn Eternal in 2015. And again, Into the Light, the most recent Panopticon album, was released in 2021, and the one-man project continues to this day and still earns the respect of both critics and fans alike. I feel it is important to start this discussion with a few different caveats and to have it established from all three of our panelists. One, what is your history with this band? And before we start all of this, how much does your national identity play into the music that you make? And yes, that's a loaded question.
So, Duel, you showed me Panopticon for the first time. After we bailed on Ensiferum, you said, have you ever checked out much American folk metal? That was it. The floodgate was open at that point.
TBF, I did go back and see Ensiferum at the end.
Yeah. You told me about that later.
Not as cool as Panopticon, let me tell you.
I appreciate you walking me home and holding my hand, bro. I think I needed it that night. But
I needed the ice cream. I remember getting the ice cream.
In terms of sort of the national identity, I would say next to none. I think that only since maybe I've been writing like country, acoustic country songs, has any of that crossed my plate. But back when I was writing metal, I would say, if anything, I was trying to jettison my sense of America, because so many of the bands that I worship were European acts, and there's sort of a, you know, especially ancestrally going back, a lot of my ancestors are from Sweden, you know, and so I like to rep that identity because of all the fantastic metal that has come out of that country.
Swedes like to rep that identity too. You talk to any Swedes.
Wink.
What about you, Donahue? What are your answers to those two questions? Preliminary questions before we start this.
Preliminary. My introduction to Kentucky was on Bandcamp. I'd say probably a year after Kentucky came out, I heard it.
Your introduction to Panopticon was Kentucky?
Yeah, it was just kind of jarring, honestly, when I first heard it. For like, oh, here's this banjo song. Here's the banjo song. It was very jarring, but I didn't have any contact again until I believe last year when we reviewed again and again Into the Light. And now we're here, pretty much my introduction to the band.
And how about national identity? How does that inform your opinion of a band or what their sound is like?
I guess it would depend on what kind of ideas they're pushing and what characteristics of that region that they, how well they put it into their music and lyrics and how well it comes out, I guess.
Yeah, the reason I said that was a loaded question is obviously usually when bands try to attach a national identity to their art, it's usually in a nationalist and or aggressive and or anti any other nationality sort of way, which is very much not how Panopticon frames it. So not I was mainly asking that question to see how you two reacted to it. And it wasn't negative. So that's a good thing, because obviously Panopticon, I think, is a positive example when you use your national and even deeper, your regional identity to your advantage. Let's go ahead and start. Black metal as a whole is littered with one-man projects. Hell, arguably one of the most famous bands in the entire genre is the result of one man, and that being Varg Vikernes's Burzum with their atmospheric black metal leanings, but we'll get to that a little bit later. It should come as no surprise that bands from other countries began to ape almost everything that Norway and to a slightly lesser extent Sweden helped to invent about black metal. The genre, once ridiculed, exploded in popularity, by underground metal standards in the mid-1990s. Everything from corpse paint, animal blood, and an affinity for Satanism was copied. And as a result, by the early 2000s, almost every black metal band looked the same. To make matters worse, a compelling argument could be made that outsized influences in the genre from bands like Emperor, Dark Funeral, Dissection, Mayhem, Dark Thrones had ensured that much of the genre actually sounded the same too. However, bands influenced by the more atmospheric side of black metal, as heard on Burzum, previously mentioned, their album Philosophem, which is widely considered to be the first atmospheric black metal record by everyone, except for Bark Fingerness himself, those influences began to surface more and more, including inside of the United States, where a band known as Agalloch carried the flag for the North Americans in the genre. And there are those that would argue to this day that they still do. I'm looking at you, Richard Donahue. Yeah.
Fucking A, brother.
There's a note in here that said you would interject right there. but another man and his one man, mostly, black metal project, have an equally compelling claim to the United States black metal throne, Panopticon. Panopticon was founded in 2007 by All Everything Man Austin Lund, a.k.a. Lundier, while he was living in Louisville, Kentucky. There's not really a plethora of information known about Austin Lund readily available. This is by design. Austin is known for declining almost all interviews that come his way. And that's not all. Prior to the release of their 2018 album, The Scars of Man on the Once Nameless Wilderness, Parts 1 and 2, he withheld all advance copies of the record so that no reviews could be written beforehand. Now, usually when this happens, this is when either the artist or the producer, the studio, whoever's putting it out, knows that what is being produced is lackluster and that the product is going to be savaged and the negative reviews will likely negatively affect sales. However, when you consider the relatively high standing amongst both fans and critics alike, we can safely assume that that's not the reason that Austin Lund withheld that record, especially considering, I think, what we're all about to say about Scars 1 and 2 coming up later on. Suffice to say, if there's one thing known about Austin Lund, is that he isn't doing Panopticon for the attention. Now, showing a little bit of a window into his way of thinking, Austin Lund, in an interview on Banger TV, which you can find on YouTube, he states that he says everything he wants to say on the albums, and he doesn't feel the need to say anything else. He also wishes to avoid being the person that, quote, only opens their mouth when it's time to change feet, which is a saying he said his family members used to tell him back when he was growing up in Kentucky, which shows some of the Southern charm behind the secrecy that he has. Despite feeling as though he says everything he needs to be said on the album, Panopticon does not publish their lyrics. Instead, they allow listeners to take Lund's message in the form of sound bites interspersed over the music from authors, philosophers, activists, and even Lund himself. Austin Lund has stated this is a way to push people in the direction of leaders who are tackling issues he wishes received more attention, such as the environment, the rights and the treatment to workers, and the labor movement as a whole, and more, who he feels can better articulate and communicate the message that he's trying to get across. With that being said, that's essentially the story of Panopticon, and that's about it. And now there's, I think, 9 full-length albums to get into, but there's a lot of meat. There's a lot of meat, and there's a lot of different ways you can interpret a lot of these albums, and that's where I want to start right now. How do you feel about the secrecy of Panopticon, and how would you contrast it with the secrecy and mysteriousness of other black metal bands? It's not exactly Mayhem with their corpse paint burning down churches, and they're all using nicknames, and that's how they're secretive. It's just Austin Lund is more like, I'm a dude from Kentucky who moved to Minnesota who makes black metal, and I don't feel like talking to you. How does that contrast to you both? And we'll start there.
I'd say it seems more forward thinking, more like he's just trying to push a message, trying to get you to look into these ideas themselves instead of being just, here's what I think, go for it, and kind of pushing it instead of being like, ew, we're in a crypt drinking virgin's blood and shit. So it seems more relatable and down to earth than his European counterparts.
Is it secrecy or is it simply a lack of engagement with the media? I don't think that they're necessarily the same thing, if you guys can understand what I'm saying by that.
Well, to be fair, he does publish a fairly large amount of information about the songs and the album in the liner notes of the record. So you're correct. It's not like he's intentionally keeping it a secret, but it's more along the lines of, if you want to know, you will buy the record and you'll find out that way, as opposed to, I'm not going to drive record sales by keeping the theme of the album a secret or my political views a secret. I feel like a lot of these bands in the scene today even benefit from, like, is this band a Nazi band? Is this band a this band? Is this band a so-and-so band?
Right.
And they never make any comments about it. They never, the controversy is beneficial to them. And I feel like, not to give too much credit here, I don't know if to say he's above it, but he definitely has no time for it, the media game, which, I don't know. For you, Bogovic, you actually actively work in the media, not necessarily the metal media, but, you know, media in general. So I feel like you would have the most interesting take on what you think about that, that the act of actively shunning it in the modern era.
Yeah, as I've said, I mean, it's, you know, these days, if you even look at the way that a band like Carcass was promoting Torn Arteries with, like, you know, their little videos designed for social media, et cetera, et cetera. It could be described as kind of an old school outlook, but one of the other bands that jumped into mind immediately that we have reviewed here on the pod is Drudk. They don't publish their lyrics, you know, Ukrainian band with possibly racist ties. You know, and I don't say that to be disparaging necessarily, but I've also talked about how I'm uncomfortable with some of their affiliations.
There's a war going on there.
And, you know, if you kind of compare and contrast these two acts, I think that Austin gives you everything that you want, but there's a little bit of a litmus test for, like, the true fan. So if you want it, you're going to fucking buy the vinyl, and it's going to give you everything that you need and everything that you want. Whereas with Drugged, you know, they're singing in an archaic language. They're not telling people what they're saying. And to me, that adds to some of the mystique, but also the controversy. And so it plays back to what you said. I don't think that Austin is necessarily trying to be vague and controversial through this. I think that he just, as you said, doesn't have time to waste, considering how prolific he is. You know, you mentioned the 9 albums, but let's not gloss over the 20 splits and, you know, 4 EPs that he has also done.
He's also an active beer brewer and has his own brewery.
Legit. And, I didn't know this.
Yeah. He actually spent time in Norway and Germany learning the old traditional European beer styles, including the old Rauch beer that you could find in Bamberg in Germany and other Norwegian beer styles that he currently makes for his own brewery, which I think is really fucking awesome. Hopefully at that true brewery concert with chemists taking place later on this year, maybe he'll bring his own. That'd be tight.
That'd be legit.
Let's also take into account the fact that a lot of these songs are like 9 to 15 fucking minutes long. Just say so. These are some dense, long piece of music as well. As well as consistently putting them out the past 10 years or so.
Yeah, dude, he's got like 10 grindcore albums worth of material in like 3 songs. And that's like on one album.
Yeah. Fucking seriously, dude.
So like, we might have listened to way more Brutal Truth albums on one of the more recent Under the Knives. But I think as far as actually listening time, this definitely is longer.
Oh, yeah, holy absolutely. Shit. But the most of any Under the Knives so far. That's all, at least since I've been on the cast.
It's my favorite one since we did Emperor. I mean, obviously, like all the ones that I pick, I'm going to enjoy more because those are the bands that I want to do. I feel like it's almost impossible to not enjoy the picks that you pick. Like, I'm sure your Type O Negative, Richard, is like your favorite one or your favorites.
Actually, I would say Nevermore, though. Didn't quite get the fanfare I wanted to, but I was very proud of it either way. So
it's not the lowest rated Under the Knife. I think that's still Candlemass, so. You got that going for you, dog.
Hey, they're actually playing up here 420. Sold out. I didn't get a ticket, though. They're playing up here on 420 in Cambridge.
Candlemass?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, they got the old singer back, right?
Lundquist. Yes. Yeah, the OG guy.
You should do that.
That's awesome. It's amazing.
You should go see that.
It's sold out, and I have Cork that day in Lowell. So
the first Panopticon album was released in 2008, and that is the self-titled album. This first album is, I wouldn't say unique in the Panopticon catalog, but it is interesting for the fact that I think it has the heaviest metalcore influences outside of perhaps Autumn Eternal, which comes out 7 years later. I don't say this as a negative, but for someone who goes into it expecting just pure raw black metal, That's not really what you get on this album, and that's not really what you get on Panopticon in general. They don't really stick to straight shots of any one particular genre, to their benefit, I might add, but we will discuss that throughout the entirety of this podcast. However, there are some things made very apparent on this record that will be made, that will become commonplace on all future Panopticon records. And that's the use of sound bites, clips, snippets of various media, or sometimes even Austin Lund himself speaking over the music to kind of convey what the overall message of the song and even the album or even the band is really all about, if you want to get that much deeper. And also, even here from the very beginning, it's not quite as present as it gets in later records, especially post Kentucky. But layering is very, very much a part of the Panopticon sound. Many times Austin Lund says, do not listen to this record on, quote, shitty speakers, your phone speaker, your laptops. Like, listen to this record when you're going out on a long hike, you're out by yourself with some headphones. So much gets lost if you're not actively listening. And in preparation for this podcast, I probably listened to Panopticon's discography 3 or 4 times. Two of them with headphones, and I found a lot of it blended together. But the more I listened with my headphones, I found that you could pick a lot more out. And obviously, as the guy who made it, he would obviously know that. But I do find it so interesting that they're one of the bands that they do genuinely feel like a different band when you listen to them with headphones. We can talk about that particular point later, but I do want to talk about the self-titled record now, Panopticon. Richard, you had mentioned the metalcore influences, so I didn't want to steal your thunder on that. You can go ahead and hate on that now, as I know you've been waiting to do, but you can also give us your other thoughts on the album.
It's not necessarily a hate thing, to be honest, because I mean, shit like Killswitch, Unearth, Shadows Fall, that's what got me into extreme metal. So I still have a love for that style of music. So what kind of blows me away is the fact how well they incorporate it in with the black metal. And it's not that jarring or like, what the fuck? On this particular album, the two songs that to me are the most that influenced were the tracks Delay of Grimnir and Archetype were very obvious with it. But again,
the Delay of Grimnir really has this really grim piano section, mm-hmm. like piano lead over the intro that gets interspersed throughout the track. And I really, really like that.
Yeah. And I would say definitely this is their most, not their best traditional style black metal, but I'd say their most traditional black metal style record that they did as a whole. Because there's like no bluegrass, no wood instruments or anything like that on this particular record.
Another song I want to talk about from this record is the I Hedonist, which yes. kind of also gives you a little bit of a insight into Austin Lund's political beliefs. It's a pretty overt criticism of religion and its, I guess, repression of sexuality. There's tons of sound bites of like, you know, what you could only assume are Christian televangelists or pastors or media personalities talking about sexual impropriety and impurity and moral decay and basically just like ripped straight out of the 80s. It gets its point across. It kind of beats you heavy a little with it.
Yes. With it. Very fucking obvious.
he gets better about these sound bites as the albums goes on. Like he definitely lays it on thick with this.
On the nose.
Yeah. A little on the nose. Bog, we haven't gotten your thoughts on this album as a whole. First off, let's get yours.
You know, I will say that after your introduction of this band to me, which certainly I don't remember exactly what we listened to, but I definitely stayed kind of within Kentucky Autumn Eternal, the Scars.
I pretty much always show everybody Come All Ye Coal Miners, the cover. And so that even non-metalheads are like, yeah, I can dig this. And then show them the black metal.
I literally didn't know that these first 4 albums existed, you know, because they're not available on YouTube Music. And so, you know, shame on me for being, I guess, wholly ignorant because of the algorithm. And so I was happy to jump on their Bandcamp and go ahead and dive into these. And I will say, like, there's a fire to these. You know, I'm making generalizations about what I'm going to call sort of the first era of this band in many ways. But it's definitely prevalent here on the Panopticon 2008, you know, eponymous record. I wouldn't call this traditional black metal because it's, to me, you know, the addition of some of the dubbing some of, we're going to call it the metalcore influence, but, you know, I almost have a note here that says there are kind of some almost pop punk kind of leads, you know, with the snare hit. There's definitely like some punk rock influence into this, which is actually kind of refreshing because, I mean, you don't hear a lot of, I don't know, blackened metalcore that's pulled off professionally or well. And now that this was produced,
says hi, at least Dan would say so.
Yeah, I don't know about that, but you know that's an argument for another under the knife, I suppose.
Have you ever heard the first Abigail Williams EP, Legend, from 2007?
Yes, it's very metalcore, actually, right? They totally change when they get to that first one, which is almost regrettable because I think I prefer that Legend style in some ways too.
I really love that Legend EP too. Love it.
So, anyways. All that to be said, like, I think, you know, to you know, get into the particular notes, like, I talk about Flagburner Torchbearer, you know, that we talk about the on-the-nose quality of it, but, you know, that's what I was talking about with the snare hit, there's some punk rock influence there. One thing that I've always loved about Panopticon, and this definitely starts, you know, basically from that track and goes through the rest of their catalog, is how unabashed Austin is with sort of his guitar leads. You know, for as layered and sort of indescript sometimes as, you know, some of these soundscapes he creates make, he really is kind of pretty brilliant in the way that he can sort of snap you right out of that with like some amazing later on sweeping and some nice melodies. And I think that in some ways I look at that as being some of the bluegrass influence coming in, even though it's not characterized as bluegrass, but it is the way that those instruments are used within that genre in some ways being actually expressed here early on in the 2008 Panopticon EP, or it's not an EP, it's a full length. Expressed in the very first eponymous record. So on the whole, you know, compared to some of their later stuff, I have a note here said that this is pretty cult. You know, the drums are a little flat in the mix for me. And I think I even listened to the remastered one. Like, I never actually heard the original version of it. And I did look for it and hoping that I could find like a tape rip on YouTube or something like that. You know, but it's, you know, I can appreciate this because it's, you know, it's the champagne, you know, broken on the bow of the ship that ultimately became something that was so incredible. So it's definitely worth respecting.
Also, one more song, if you don't mind, I'd like to bring up is Emma's song, probably my other favorite song off the record. That Flagbird Hiatus to be the three standouts for sure.
Emma's song has got some real like Blackwater Park kind of like. I think you know, for the first time, like I saw kind of what this band was going to become inside of that track.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you mentioned that. It's interesting that you mentioned that, Bog, because I mentioned the metalcore influences earlier, and I was trying to think what was going on in the world of heavy metal, particularly in the United States in 2007 and 2008. And Donahue, you mentioned Killswitch Engage.
Just Fall on Earth, As I Lay Dying, yeah. All That Remains.
Trivium was about to put out Shogun, I think, the next year. Like, metalcore was in its like at its peak, so I kind of understand why it is there. And like Austin obviously gets much more into the Americana and the black metal as he starts to become more and more of a solo artist. He talks about how like basically he used to have like a bunch of these metal bands that he'd have, and eventually he just slowly drifted away from working with other people just because he's a bit of a control freak, which I get. I think most artists are control freaks.
Look at you, Dave Mustaine and Peter Steele.
Yeah. So when it works out, everyone's like, oh, yeah, he's allowed to be a control freak. But I'm sure all of his bandmates at the time was like, what a fucking dick. He doesn't compromise for anything.
Chuck Schuldiner as well. Another obvious one.
Every single, as you notice with all the death documentaries, all those people who are all like, fuck Chuck, he fired me. I no one can work with that asshole. It's like, I played with Chuck Schuldiner. I was in a band with him.
Total 180. Yeah, definitely 100%.
Yeah. Success changes everything. It's funny. Before we move on to the second record, Collapse, fun story about this first record, Panopticon. On the first full length, the first 100 copies of the disc that were printed has an incorrect track listing on the first page of the booklet, because track 4 is listed as interlude, quote unquote, but there is no interlude on this album. Therefore, it's printed incorrectly. And there's also a small typo in the lay of Grimnir. Austin Lund personally apologizes for this blunder, and he also encourages you to email him for the correct Trask listing. There's also a bonus track on this cover, on this album. It's a cover of Amoebix's ICBM.
Yeah, it's all right. I didn't care for it. I didn't really hate it either. It was just kind of there for me, at least.
Yeah, I would say so. Moving on now to the second release. Like we said earlier, there's really not a whole lot that happens narratively speaking here, so we will just be kind of traveling from release to release. It does get more fun to talk about, I promise. The next album, Collapse. Do either of you two, I guess the biggest thing I should ask before we spend too much on this record is, how much difference do you find between the self-titled Panopticon release and Collapse, if any? And if so, where? And where do you see that initial evolution into what Panopticon eventually becomes on this album? I started with you previously, Donahue, so I will start with Bog this time.
Well, let me just say that there is the banjo on Collapse, and we didn't have any on Panopticon, and so there's one big difference.
That's what I was looking for, my guy.
Is that we have the sort of synecdoche element that becomes what this band is basically known for. Frankly, I think that this one sounds better. You know, again, I only listened to sort of the remastered versions of all of this, but I don't think at any point until basically very recently did Panopticon not take a significant step up in production basically with every release, which is kind of what you want from an act. But yeah, that's the big difference, man, is here we got that Americana.
I guess the biggest difference to me is I feel it's a bit more focused and the production is like a smidge better. Not by much, but like a slight panache. I notice a slight bit more polish, and there was noticeable growls on that weren't necessarily on the first one. And as Pete said, the bluegrass influence finally rears its head properly instead of like hiding in the background. But minus that, I mean, not too terribly much difference, to be honest.
Yeah, I don't want to like shit on this record by any stretch of the imagination, because it is very good.
In my opinion, it's better than the first record.
I will come along with you on that. However, the only thing I'm trying to explain here is, as we said before, there is not a whole lot of narrative going on with this band, and so it is mostly talking about the content, but most of what we discussed as far as content wise on the first record also kind of goes for right here for this second record, Collapse. And there's still only four songs. The Death of Baldur and the Coming War kind of illustrates the entire concept of the record. If you know anything about Baldur and like Norse mythology, as far as like when he dies and like the forever war that comes afterwards, and there's a lot of sound bites from various news organizations and talking about just how shitty things happening in the world. You very much get the sense of like a society collapse and like shit's coming unglued.
It starts with somebody basically narrating like the collapse of the social security system in the United States. You know, I mean, certainly is, we talk about being on the nose, but he's not, you know, he's not pulling any punches with his criticisms of the United States, which I actually very much appreciate, you know?
Yeah. Honesty's best policy, as they say.
And I mean, the record is called Collapse after all. So I guess once again, on the nose.
I would say my two favorite tracks off the record, I was only four, would be Merkstab or Merkstave, how you pronounce it. And I'm going to butcher this. Apterganger. APTRGANGR. Those are two favorites overall. So
I do appreciate how even a band like Panopticon and Austin Lunn, who is so tied to United States black metal and Americana and an American identity, has so many songs in Norwegian, titled in Norwegian.
Yeah.
It's funny, isn't it?
Well, you said he went to Norway. Does he have ancestors there? I mean, he must have some kind of familial tie other than maybe
absolutely.
Just like...
I mean, he's got to. If he was out there brewing beer. I mean, ancestrally, of course. I mean, I can't talk shit. My band's called Finsterness, you know, from my ancestral German shit. But I just find it funny. My band's never been associated with like the American black metal band. And it is funny that the American black metal band has, in my opinion, has so much Norwegian influence. Even in like, you know, song titles.
Does that make it more American to you, Duel? In some ways it does for me. You know what I mean?
America is a melting pot. Whether everyone has forgotten this or not, I don't think that influence from any other country makes it less American, because America is just a mix of where we all came from.
Yeah. Right.
We killed all the real Americans, unfortunately. Without getting too dark there. Sorry.
A little too real, man.
So after their second release, Collapse, Panopticon would go on to release their third full length in 2010, entitled On the Subject of Mortality. There are some classic tracks, IMO, on this record. And this would not be the first time, or the last time, I should say, that we would see these songs featured on Panopticon albums. More on that later. However, starting off with Living in the Valley of the Shadow of Death, all the way through the last track, Watching You, one, the samples loom large on this record. Thirdly, the black metal is very much here. And this is also when Austin Lund starts to get almost brazenly political. This, it feels like the most anti-religious of all the Panopticon albums, which is the most milquetoast political opinion I think you can take in metal, to be anti-Christianity or anti-religion.
For sure.
He very much gets more into real societal issues on later albums, as opposed to Invisible Man in the Sky, Bad. Which I don't want to like sweep everything he says on this album under the rug. What he is saying is true and important, but I just think that that belief is held by a majority of the metalhead listening public. Let's be real. Without diminishing what he's trying to say on this record, what did you boys think of On the Subject of Mortality? And tell me why Living in the Valley of the Shadow of Death, Living Eulogy, and A Message to the Missionary are three of Panopticon's best songs.
Well, that jazzy intro on Living in the Valley of the Shadow of Death is certainly sort of a new offering that it is going to persist throughout the rest of their catalog. I loved that soundscape. And it also was kind of one of the first times, I know I talked about how unabashed he was with his use of guitar leads. His ability to sweep, guitar sweeping, showed up really, really pronounced on towards the end of that track as well. Sort of post the 9 minute 30 second mark.
No big deal. Just past the 9.5 minute mark. That's what gets real.
It's probably important for us to acknowledge that a lot of these, you know, sort of important tracks off of all of these records are pushing 10 minutes in, you know, many, many instances. And yes. I really consider each one of them to be a novel unto themselves, you know, and there are certain people who can consume music like this. You know, we talked about how he says to not listen to it on shit speakers, and you could, you know, see that as a little bit of like subtle self-promotion for him to try and encourage people to have the best experience. But I also think that the way that he writes his music can and probably is lost on those who are not, you said the term dual active listening, which, you know, as three blokes who do a heavy metal podcast, I think that we're accustomed to doing. And I think that sort of a more casual, even metal consumer, let alone the folks who are just listening to Ariana Grande, are not going to be able to do.
I think we take it for granted, honestly, not only just us three together as a group, like to assume that other people do it when we discuss music critically. Like, are Ariana Grande fans discussing critically her albums?
No, but they're doing a lot like more dancing. That's for sure.
That's true. But like us on this podcast and the metalhead community at large, I think, are all active listening. And I think that's why there is this almost vitriolic troll/hate crew that no one in the metal community, whether it's us as podcasters or the artists themselves or even fans for liking the bands, they're like, no one is safe, because everyone, as part of being in the active listening community, has such a fucking pronounced opinion about every little thing.
For sure. And it just comes out of the fandom. Like, you put this much love and attention to something, you want to get what you get out of it, and we don't get the product you want, you get a little pissy about it. Especially when, you know, said artists are shitting on you because you don't like their new musical direction.
Just to address like a couple of the things that you intro'd this album to, like the use of samples certainly shows up on To Make an Idol Out of Our Fear and Call It God, you know, which again is that on the nose, you know, criticism of
great song title.
Yeah, it's I don't know. I'm gonna say like, you know, maybe a tinge eye rolly for me, but I love the track itself, and that middle part too. It's interesting. There's kind of there's international languages that are being spoken here, and that one in particular in the middle, I couldn't tell if it was Russian exactly. Like I didn't have a good acuity to that. And then jumping ahead to watching you, basically the outro of the record, I couldn't tell if they were speaking like Japanese or maybe like, you know, some form of, you know, Norwegian or Swedish or something like that too. So.
Oh, man, I thought you were about to steal my thunder. I'm so glad you didn't say it. There's a third song on there with a foreign language on A Message to the Missionary, Dies Irae. It is performed in the 1957 Swedish film called The Seventh Seal that is featured prominently throughout that track.
I was going to touch on that. I actually, if you don't mind, I have a quote from an interview he did on bandcamp.com discussing that. And it goes as follows. When I was 19 years old, I discovered Ingmar Bergman's The Seventh Seal from 1957. I watched it over and over again, absorbing the deep meaning of the internal struggle with mortality and religion. It hit me like a ton of bricks. When I was 22, in 2005, my old man passed away, that I truly understood its meaning. While mourning, I developed intense death anxiety, and suddenly the finite nature of life became so abundantly clear to me. We aren't long for this world, and we have to make the most out of the time that we have left, which is a very real and deep shit there. And another thought I have on this record, at least, is I feel this is the most Agalockian, a.k.a. Agalock influence, out of
all. Are we putting that in the Webster's Dictionary, Agalockian?
Agalockian, yes.
Word of the year, Agalockian.
Agalockian. Yeah, as a huge fan of Agalock, I'm not mad at that at all. But thankfully, after this record, we kind of stray away from this overt sense of it. But I also feel as well, this is the first record where they've really, the black metal, the bluegrass, and the use of samples all done, I would say, properly. It'll get better as records go on. But at this point in their career, it's the best fermentation of all these elements into one product.
I feel like the band at this point is kind of not necessarily circling the toilet bowl, but they're doing the same thing with minor but gradual improvements, whether it be the use of the samplings as far as making them more effective and not being overtly reliant on them. The production value is obviously getting a little bit better because Austin's doing it more and more often, but also the songwriting is getting a little bit better. But more and more, Panopticon is starting to sound more and more like Panopticon. If there is a criticism that you could put on the earlier records, is that you could argue that they could be a bit lost in the black metal shuffle, much like in my intro when I said that a lot of black metal kind of sounded the same by the mid-2000s. And while I'd never think they just sound like a run-of-the-mill Norwegian black metal yada yada fuck-off band, they definitely do sound closer to the mold in that first two records. And this is where I feel like they really start to become Panopticon, especially on the next release. But here I really hear
there's
it.
More of a point of view on this one. I think that this one feels more like a concept album, whereas the other ones, I mean, there were certain elements of it, but it was mostly just like anger, I guess is what I got. You know, it sort of bounced around. Yeah. You know, you look at the title on the subject of morality, there's a heavy duty religious influence here. So on the subject of morality, right? That's basically what religious, you know, doctrine is scribed for, is to address that itself.
And this is also one of the first times, but not the last time, where Austin actively talks about things that affected him in his life. As Richard said before, this record's got a lot to do with the death of his father. And obviously, growing up in Louisville, Kentucky, he doesn't actively say this, but as someone who grew up in the South, I know many people who grew up in Kentucky, especially Louisville, Kentucky, I highly clean edit. I knew people who grew up in Louisville, Kentucky. I can almost fucking guarantee that, like me, who grew up in Mobile, Alabama, or Richard Donahue, who grew up in Mississippi, there was someone cracking the whip about the good Lord and fucking church and morality and going to heaven and hell and all that shit in his life. And so, you know, obviously when someone as big as your father passes away and you actually have to grapple with these things that have been beaten into your head your whole life, obviously that's going to affect you. Especially when you realize that those answers, quote unquote, aren't really answers at all. I really appreciate that. This could very easily get very cliched, but I don't feel like it does.
It verges on it a little bit for me. The dub of people being whipped on A Message to the Missionary, like, you know.
Yeah.
I mean,
bit on the nose, but I mean, it's metal, so there's to be that type of
it's not even really a criticism sometime. Like, I want to applaud him for you know, just first of all putting out three records in 3 years, you know, as sort of a self-funded self-motivated you know,
prolific, my
yeah
guy.
Absolutely, prolific. I said it earlier too, so it's not really as a metaphor criticism. Again, metal podcast, I'm pushing the bridge of my glasses up against my forehead here, you know.
I see you are a man of culture as well.
Another note I have here, this is from the man himself, and he talks about this record specifically, the remix remaster version is actually his favorite record out of all.
Really?
Yes.
Revisions of the Past, you know, but I'm going to save this for later. We're going to get to that. We're going to get to that. And, that actually leads us. Well, go ahead and say what you say. I have something to say after.
So it's all good. And one song y'all did mention was another favorite of mine, was the song Seeing. Period, period, period. Another one of my favorites off the record.
I'll talk about this when we get to Revisions of the Past. I have something to say about that song. Preface to that record that we'll get to in probably 15 or 20 minutes or so. What did y'all think of the production quality on this record?
Talking about Seeing, I think that I have a note here that the drums sounded blown out on that one. And that was me even listening to sort of the remaster version of it. But
But did you listen to it with headphones, bro? Or was it on your shitty cell phone speakers?
It's funny. Like, I got my Daith pierced 3 weeks ago. And so I've only been able to do like one headphone, you know? And so like a lot of it was.
Bro, is there something you want to tell us? You got the fucking fingernails? You got the new piercing,
fuck, man?
Bro? You got the acid wash denim jacket?
Acid wash denim jacket is right in my fucking alley, bro. I'm reinventing myself in 2022, man. Just because the beard is gone doesn't mean, you know.
It's the Bay Area. The Bay Area is coming out.
Fucking A. I don't even remember what I was saying now. Something.
Sorry, I was talking too much shit. Donahue, I think you were saying something.
I would say with the production here, there's not that much of a difference. I actually would say it might take a slight step back from Collapse, though the songs are much better.
Back?
Like a smidge, like a slight, not like a big difference. Kind of like Collapse from the first album, the Collapse was a slight difference, and this one made a slight difference, an element or two, but it's really about the same. Not that.
Y'all notice how those layers are getting thicker and thicker? It's not just like three, four, five layers. It's starting to be like, all right, this is a little overkill. So you're saying if this production is a little bit muddier than last time, I think it's just because he's adding more and more and he doesn't quite know how to juggle quite as many objects in the air as he's trying to at this point in time.
For sure, definitely. This isn't Queen Night the Opera levels of layering or anything. But, yeah.
deep cut. All right, whatever. You assume our metalhead listeners even listen to Queen, sir.
Well, that sounds like a personal problem to me because you're missing the fuck out.
I would agree. Let's move on to essentially the second part of this album. So on the subject Mortality, which is itself a compilation of previously released tracks that were put out on various different Panopticon splits with bands like Skagos and When Bitter Sleeps. That's like the entirety of On the Subject of Mortality. And the second record that essentially comes right after this, that was kind of written in the same headspace when those songs were being written, is entitled Social Disservices. And this is really when Austin Lund starts to turn his eye away from religion and like more cliched political topics to very specific American-leaning labor movement focused stuff. And this is where Austin Lund admittedly talks about him being a labor focused anarchist, which is where his political views really start to come into the foray. As far as being on the far left, we have Comrade Loker. He's beyond being Comrade Lund. He's full anarchy at this point.
Insert him in Soviet style, you know, Lenin style fucking painting, like preaching to the masses.
He's beyond it. He's beyond it. Let's start off with the first track. I mean, everything from like, what was that song title that you thought we made an idol out of our fear and called it God?
Yeah, this record
goes the entire 180. All four titles are one word: resident, client, subject, patient.
Patient.
Very cold.
It's very direct, and me listening to it, I felt this was his best take, barred on just pure black metal. This is those to me evil sounding Panopticon record, like pure focus.
As a whole, yes. Not the blackest slab of music. We'll get to that later, as we've discussed previously pregame. But yes, this is definitely his most pissed off record.
Man.
Yeah. I think definitely he tries to find the light in shitty situations later on, but there's a lot more triumphant amidst the sadness and the sorrow. But this one's just like, life is fucked and it's fucked. And that's just all he's trying to say here, which I really get. I feel like as a 25-year-old, if I had those political beliefs that I have now, then I could definitely see where he was coming from. Just the anger. You don't really care about a solution. Just like, this is fucked.
One thing that I will say is that I think that the drums actually play an important part on this record, whereas previously, you know, they were kind of just there for the intensity, more or less. You know, I don't mean to cut them down so much, but I don't know exactly how they were created initially, because I think I was listening to the redone elements. But in this one, especially when I think about you know, the first track, Resident, you know, it comes in with the kids playing basically, and I don't know exactly, you know, I assume that it's about some kind of public housing, you know, complex. And the album cover to me is also potentially like a reference to bullying too, at least the one that I saw.
It's got like a guy on his hands and knees getting stabbed in the back.
I just took it to me as like kind of just despair, because this is about him. He used to be a social worker, and all the lyrics of the record were influenced by that. So I just take it as just that feeling, being that headspace, that disparity. There's no hope. There's no way to get out of the situation. That's what I took from the album cover personally.
I will say to sort of elevate them, but like Resident to me came off as pretty like emperorish. You know, like there's a density and thickness and also like intensity to it, you know, that I think was really, really sort of flirting with that to me.
You would take that back,
no.
Bro?
If I squinch really hard, I can kind of see where it comes from. Just kind of.
I gotta feed the trolls here, man.
Soft boy.
Another thing about this record I do like a lot, surprisingly, the vocal filters. I have a nitpick. I hate that shit with a burning passion, but the vocal filters here really elevate the anger.
They can't be blown out, because otherwise Bog would have had a conniption fit.
That's more his thing. To me,
I have no notes here. I definitely would have written it down if it were there.
So, and in my humble opinion, the crowning achievement of this whole record would be the final track, Patient, that just fucking slams. It is just 20 goddamn minutes of...
If this record wasn't four songs, all like 10 minutes plus, I feel like this record would have gotten Panopticon the attention that Kentucky got them on their next release.
Yeah,
it's definitely just too niche, too political, too angry, and too drawn out. I feel like the black metal community was like, yeah, this band, we should check this band out. So they were poised. So when Kentucky came out and when they really dive into the Americana, they're like, this band plays fucking banjos. And I'm not going to lie, like Bog, Kentucky was the first album, the next one, that I discovered Panopticon on. And that's why I showed everybody first. And like Bog, for a while, not like this year, but I didn't realize there was previous records. I knew of Collapse, but when Richard pregame said, talking about the self-titled Panopticon album, I didn't know that existed until we did this.
Fucking poser. Yeah.
I knew Collapse existed. I thought that was the furthest back. I was like, self-titled Panopticon? This is like a YouTube fucking nonsense. No, it exists. It exists.
Don't challenge my metal elitism, Duel. You'll always lose, just so you know.
Apparently. On this case, I'll give that to you. I'll give that one to you, brother. Out of curiosity, we're four records in now. We've got Panopticon, the self-title. We've got Collapse. We've got On the Subject of Mortality. And now we have Social Disservices. And the band is evolving in various different ways, with it via the use of sound effects, samples, political leanings, and just Austin Lund's general songwriting, and developing more of an identity as far as who Panopticon is. Where would you rank this band right now? And would they even be worthy of attention if this was the entirety of their catalog? Because I would argue there's still a lot to digest here. And we're not doing it right now because we still got five more albums to get through. So we're kind of skimming. I'm just curious. I just want to give these albums their due, or hear what get both of your takes on these four albums kind of as a whole, and where you see this evolution through the first four albums before we move forward. Because I feel like starting with Kentucky, this is a whole new band.
A rebirth, if you will.
So yes. I would say that social disservices to me is almost, I don't want to overlook this record, because while Kentucky, I think, takes a big step forward in terms of their, I would say, cultural and American perspective on the music, it's not completely absent from the earlier records, but what they do is they take a little bit more of an introspective look on social disservices. And I was characterizing it actually, not even because, you know, it's stylistically the same, but I think about the difference between Scream Bloody Gore and Leprosy, the first two Death records. And one of the biggest differences between those two records is that Scream Bloody Gore is trite, sort of genre towing violent lyrics, and then Leprosy starts to move towards what actually becomes one of the hallmarks of Death's greater catalog, which is some of the social realism or graphic realism. And I think that on social disservices, that's where I got the sense of that, is that, not to say that the political anger wasn't real, but it didn't feel unique. It didn't feel pointed. And I think that Austin seems to have burned that fuel and then at some point turned inside himself on that record. And I think that it becomes more fully expressed, I think, because the production value certainly gets a little bit of a boost, and we'll talk about that in a second. But I would say, to me, we were talking about the first four, and I would say I really feel like there's the first three, then there's Social Disservices, and then there's kind of like the sort of second chapter of that. You know, I think it's a very transitional and important record, in my opinion. And I'm very positive on Social Disservices. I would encourage anybody who has only ever heard Kentucky or even some of, you know, Autumn Eternal Post, as I admitted myself, wasn't willing to go back and take a listen to it. It's four tracks. One of them is 20 minutes long, you know, but get through it, because you will be better for it.
This is an elbow joint record.
Yeah.
Social Disservices is right here. This is what you need to flex that muscle, which is what everything else happens with Panopticon.
It's later. A great metaphor for it. Absolutely.
This record needed to exist. And in a way, it's one of their quote unquote cultist releases. Four songs, all long as fuck. This is not an easily digestible record.
Not approachable.
It's political. Yeah. It's angry as fuck. And you kind of have to know what's going on to even, as far as the political and labor climate in the United States, to even get what the fuck he's talking about. Not an approachable record in any way, shape, and or form, but it's still fucking awesome.
It's amazing.
Still fucking fantastic, for sure. Going to your question from earlier, honestly, even the career had ended here, thankfully it didn't, Buffett had, I would say you still saw they ascended from the first record being, I'd say, overall the worst, still solid basis. Each record got a little better songwriting wise in using the different genres and elements. And this one here would have been the great achievement and the most darkest and evil, especially relating to real world issues of demons and ghosts and Satan and whatnot. So definitely of this era of the band, I would say Social Services is the highlight of that era. And I do want to call off the opening track, Resident, as well. And though Patient, I feel, is the crowning, the gold jewel of the entire record, all the Resident, is a great opening track as well.
All right, so I'm glad we got to talk about that record and how it is essentially a pivot. So yes. After the release of Social Disservices in 2011, and let's just be fucking real here, let's just go over what Panopticon's been doing. So they put out their self-titled debut in 2008. They put out a single, La Passion de Sacco and Vanzetti, in 2008 as well. They put out the Panopticon and Lake of Blood split in 2009, as well as the It's Lighter Than You Think split in 2009, followed by the full-length Collapse also in 2009, and then the Subject of Mortality full-length in 2010, and then a split with Skagos in 2010, a split with When Bitter Spring Sleeps also in 2010, and then another split with Wheels Within Wheels in 2011. Followed by the full-length Social Disservices in 2011. So holy fuck, you would think this band has gotten tired of doing what they do. And in a way they did, because now they pivot into the shining example of United States black metal, according to I, Dual Guest. You can call me a cringe, soft, whatever the fuck nonsense insult you want to on Instagram for that opinion. But the next record that comes out, Kentucky, is what got me into this band. It's the album that I show so many people to get them into this band. And the reason I do it is because it's effective. There's very few people who I show this record in Kentucky that don't become fans of this band, even non-metal fans. just because this is also when the Americana starts to take center stage in songs. They're like outright just like folk and banjo songs on the record. They're not just passages in a black metal song. They get full songs themselves. And that's a theme that will continue. And they'll even get their whole album, multiple albums just of that later on. But we'll get to that later. Kentucky, total turning point for this band. It cannot be emphasized enough, both as far as their relevance to the metal community, what they're talking about. It's more about the labor movement, especially the coal miners taking place in Kentucky and West Virginia. Very much a blue collar working class point of view on this record. But also, this is the first approachable, quote unquote, panopticon.
No shit.
Panopticon record. As in, there are songs under 8 minutes long on this record. That's what I mean. There are also three working class songs that are covered on this record, which are Which Side Are You On, Black Waters, and Come All Ye Coal Miners.
Which, so those are day, covers?
Those are traditional.
Oh.
Those songs were sung by the workers when they were going through the shit.
I thought those are original. Oh,
traditional Appalachian folk music. Yeah.
Shit, I thought it was like original. He wrote those for the record.
He interprets them. They're definitely like very distinct point of views on those tracks. But I myself was, when I heard Come All Ye Coal Miners, like the original version, it's actually sung by a woman, you know, in the original version. Yes. Like, but it's a distinctive point of view on it.
Which we'll get to it in our top 10, but Come All Ye Coal Miners is the first thing I show everybody when I show them Panopticon, because it's such a powerful cover and most people don't even realize it's a cover. Like, not to get too political, but labor movement and labor struggles are so forgotten in this country. People forget that less than 100 years ago, people in West Virginia were in open fucking warfare with corporations over fucking labor. And now we've got people just like, who cares? The minimum wage doesn't go up. It's crazy what happens in 100 years. But anyway, this record, Kentucky. Yeah, you can follow me later on the fucking Dual Guest Political Hour.
That's tell
me
about paywall this content.
Yeah. Bob, people would pay if you and me went shot for shot with Jameson and just went off the cuff on political comments. They'd pay for it.
I would commentate.
And Bog moderates. He's laughing his dick off over there because he knows it's gold. He knows it's gold.
So here's my thoughts on this record. This is, like many people, this is my introduction to the band as a whole. And at the time, I'll be real, I wasn't very big into black metal at all, like somewhat, like a little Enslaved, a little Rotted Christ. That's really my extent, or a little Immortal. That's my extent to black metal. So this was very jarring, to be honest. It's like, you know, banjo, all this very kind of progressive black metal song with acoustics and very dynamic. And it's like, it kind of turned me away. And I didn't really, I mean, honestly, I didn't listen to it again until this Under the Knife. And my second exposure to the band was, again, Into the Light. So experience the whole catalog and going into this record again, seeing it with a different lens, it's, in a way, their black album. And I mean that actually in a good way, not a bad way.
That's such a like, weird characterization. Like, you posted that in the Slack channel, man, and like that's still like...
I still stand
like, they're black.
It is in the sense that it's accessible. It's the most accessible to this
I
time.
Guess that,
but
that's the way I mean it.
This is a progressive record. Like, the black album was a step back, like for Metallica.
No, it's still progressive. They moved to a completely different frame of mind, use of melody. It's just triumph.
I think a more appropriate, even thrash example, is that this is their Reign of Blood.
I was thinking that.
This is where they burst on this on the fucking scene. People knew about them, but this is where, like, okay, now we take you seriously.
So this is the record that we judge all Panopticon records by?
Absolutely. Like, this is the pivot record. I think every Panopticon record gets compared to this one. Obviously, Autumn Eternal is about to come. But the reason I say Reign of Blood and not the Black Album, because there's no good Metallica album after Black Album to compare it to, whereas there's nothing but good Panopticon.
Okay, you, fair point.
You still have South of Heaven and Seasons of the Abyss later to compare Reign of Blood to, as well as Haunting the Chapel and
Music Diabolus and Diabolus, right?
That's on you, dog. That's on you.
This record, seeing it through this lens now, is a
Fucking well, great. Let's just go ahead and describe it a little bit for folks who haven't heard it before, you know, which is kind of a shame. And I don't know how many people are going to be listening to this who have never done it before. But the intro is all, you know, acoustic. And then we jump into Bodies Under the Falls and it slams you.
Time, Forest, and Spring, the intro you talk
correct.
About.
But then as soon as you get into our you know, very first sort of Panopticon-esque 10 minutes and 27 second track number two, you get slammed immediately with Penny Whistle leads, which again is a traditional music, which is why they are often characterized as American folk metal, you know, in addition to the banjo that is prominently featured here. This is a very distinct sound, and there's really nobody else doing anything like this. I mean, can you guys find off the top of your heads, you know, the three metal elitists that we are, think of anybody that is scratching this territory? Is there anybody anywhere near this?
This point that you're making right now is why I dub Panopticon the United States black metal band, because while Agalloch might have been the first, no one is delving into actual American music, Americana, like Panopticon, and doing it so well. It'd be one thing if they had some cringe banjo song, Watanes They Wrote On or some shit on
hey,
like
hey, that's
one.
The best off the record. I dog shit.
Not to detract from them, but the only band that I can think of is probably Wayfarer. And they are working with their own kind of American sort of the sensibility of Western sound.
Vibe, yeah.
But they still aren't using traditional instrumentation in the way that Panopticon is so – Austin is so willing to incorporate not just banjo, but like, you know, fucking bluegrass. Like, I didn't know I liked this shit as much as I did until I was listening to this. You know, it's funny. It's made listening to Panopticon has made me realize like how technical bluegrass is. You know, you actually go back and listen to it. I'm like, dude, this guy's shredding.
So.
Like, this is insane.
Chicken picking. That shit's next level. Yeah. Really
Austin Lund's stepfather was actually a very prominent country music musician in Nashville. I wish I knew his name because it's mentioned on that Banger TV interview. He's a prominent musician playing with a very popular band. I don't know if it was the Avett Brothers, but he played with a very known band, and it's killing me that I can't remember it off the top of my head. And he talks about how it's a bit of a scandal how he chose to pursue metal and not country music. How he was a bit of a name in Nashville country music.
It's not Avett, it's like Arquette. What is the name of that artist?
Look up the Banger TV interview on YouTube with Austin Lund. It's fantastic. He gives his story in detail and much, much better than I can remember it right now. So just hear it from his words. But his stepfather is a prominent country music musician. He grew up around country music, was expected to follow in the footsteps of country music as a drummer, but eventually got more into punk rock and metal and by extension black metal, and chose to pursue Panopticon instead. So these Americana and country influences are kind of his upbringing rearing
genuinely,
themselves.
It's not like a put on, it's not like, oh, hey, I'm going to adopt this persona, be this. This was, he's literally homegrown. Yeah. Genuine and authentic.
I think that's why it's so good, too. It's not tacked on. It's not like, I'm going to be country black metal.
One thing I say from this point, from Lund's career on, is the previous records did have their emotive parts, but this, the emotion, the melodies are so authentic. You could really vibe with them in a deep sense that you necessarily didn't have in the prior records. They were heavier, angrier, darker, insert adjectives here. Very much more down to earth than real music. It's probably the Americana influence coming in prominently. It's fucking beautiful.
Yeah, one thing that I'd like to do is just read the track listing too, because I think it's going to give you a pretty good idea about the narrative happening here. We have Bernheim, Forest, and Spring, Bodies Under the Falls, Come All Ye Coal Miners, which we talked about as a cover, Black Soot and Red Blood. Which Side Are You On? With a question mark. We have punctuation in the song title here. Killing
there.
The Giants As They Sleep. Black Waters, and then the final track is called Kentucky, the eponymous song as well. And so I think he can certainly string together at least some kind of narrative about what he's talking about. And where this pivots from social disservices, obviously that was a little bit of a pun on social services, where he was basically taking on all of government and all of any public services, potentially in this country, and maybe others, you know, if you wanted to read into that, to something that is a little bit more hyper-specific to the area that he is from. And I think that this is where they really tried to blossom, is he's actually using his penchant for criticism to look at a historical moment that is often overlooked and forgotten. And in many ways, people from this area celebrate their heritage as, you know, being coal miners, when it actually was one of the biggest atrocities that this country ever faced in the way that he's presenting it.
This is This is what I was talking about earlier. The same people who were literally in open warfare against these mining companies who were getting paid in coupons to the company store and nothing at that are all of a sudden voting for people who praise that shit. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. It's like, no, your granddaddy was literally shooting those people who said that. And now you vote for the people who fucking do it, which that's kind of why I get his anger.
Well, there's that monologue in Black Soot and Red Blood that literally talks about them unionizing and how like the managers would come and beat them with the slate, you know, when they were trying to pick it out of their boots because they didn't want to waste that shit. I mean, it's totally crazy. I'm not originally from the South. I guess Kentucky's a South. It's funny. I mean, here in New Orleans, you know, I view that as being certainly more Northern, but culturally,
it's definitely a Southern
culturally
state.
Being from Northern For California, sure. I don't quite understand, you know, some of the nuance between, you know, that articulation, but also, Duel and I have a mutual friend who is from Louisville and he definitely identifies as being Southern, although it's also like a little bit of a controversial thing to him too. You know, that sense of identity, is separate from, you know,
let me tell you, that's Louisville people having an identity crisis. As a Bama boy, them Kentuckians are Southern boys. they fought on the fucking Confederate side.
I think it's kind of fascinating, and it's an untold part of this country, and I actually really like it a lot because, again, it's a good example of Southerners telling the stories of the South in a way that isn't Fox News. You know, and not to, again, get too political here, but I think that as someone who has transplanted to the South and is married to a Southerner, it's important that this effort is made, and hopefully that it gets national attention, because I think that a lot of places in the rest of the country definitely don't take this seriously. And I think that these introspections are the most tantalizing offerings to it. And I think Kentucky is such a phenomenal example, and it's you know, it's such an incredible album that certainly propelled this band to the rest of everything else that they ever did. One thing that I kind of don't want to gloss over here is that, you know, we're both sort of, you know, taking a powder on some of the political issues here, but I personally resonate with the political sentiment that is expressed here. But I actually would love to hear someone who is on the other side of the aisle, so to speak, and what their opinion on this is. You know, we talk about how it's sort of a left and right thing. I think that this could be.
Are you talking about being an anti-workers' rights
person? Just like more of an avowed capitalist than I am personally, you know, and that has to do with my upbringing on the West Coast. But
So somebody who didn't work in the mines.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, this could be considered way more charged than it was for me, where I'm like, obviously they were treated horribly, et cetera, et cetera. Like, you know, someone with a different political view could interpret this if they took the time to actually listen to the dubs, you know, and internalize some of the struggles. Yeah, I don't think anybody is for necessarily, like, you know, gross worker mistreatment. But when you hear some of these arguments about how we need to propagate, you know, capitalism, I would be very curious to hear the reaction to this. I don't know anybody like that in my life, but it's a complete, you know, it's a totally valid take on this record as well, which I think is kind of why it's fantastic, too, is that this can be, I don't want to say spun, but it's charged enough that you can certainly internalize it and come out with a completely different reaction and take on it, depending on where you stand.
If you're speaking about the coal miners specifically,
Austin certainly positions it as an oppressive environment.
I can imagine,
like, you know, there isn't any. He's not pulling any punches.
Just the imagery, the lyrics, the records reminds me of the pictures of four to like 7-year-old children from the British Industrial Revolution, like when the machines have to go with this lawyers reach in and grab the tools, it'd be disfigured. You see the picture of the 1910s of like these little kids smoking. They look like they're like 50-year-old fucking men because they're that young. I've been through all this harsh reality. It's disturbing, to be really honest.
Is there anything else you gentlemen would like to say about the monumental record?
Closing notes, at least on my part for Kentucky, two of my favorite tracks would be Bodies Under the Fall and Killing the Giants as They Sleep. And to quote Lund about Kentucky, the album was also the first record I pushed myself to record folk music on, something that later become the focal point in my musical endeavors, end quote.
This would also be the last record for 2 years, because there would be two splits, Vestiges and Panopticon split in 2014. And there would also be a split called Brotherhood with Fall of Rauros as well, also to be released in 2014. And it is also in the year of our Lord, 2014, that we find ourselves listening to Roads to the North, another deeply personal record for Austin Lunn. Roast of the North is important because it is essentially a chronicling of Austin Lunn's move from his hometown of Louisville, Kentucky, to the frozen north of Minnesota. Talk about moving to a more appropriate black metal landscape, so to speak.
Yeah, right.
A little bit less political than its previous effort, Kentucky. This one is a much more personal and introspective record. And this is also where we begin to see a little bit of the reemergence of metalcore, I would say.
Yeah.
Which also leans into the fact that this is a more personal record. I feel like the more political ones with the Americana, like Kentucky and Social Disservices, were very much based in black metal with little Americana influences. But this one actually incorporates American metal influences into the Norwegian metal influences, as well as the American folk influences, i.e. the perfect panopticon mix, as we will see on the albums going forward. Let me start off with Bakrovich, because I've got a feeling he is the greatest champion of this record. I've got a feeling it's his favorite. Bog, tell us about Roast of the North.
One of the things that really stood out to me immediately is the way that some of the folk applications and bluegrass influence didn't come out so boxed out, sort of bento boxed, and where there were these passages and songs that were that, and then it went into metal. In fact, that they are quite fused together very effectively on this record. And I think that that's what makes this, to me, a little bit of a superior record to Kentucky, in that that's where some of that was birthed. And I don't want to say that it didn't exist, because I was trying to highlight the moments and when we saw banjo, especially on, you know, Collapse for the first time. But I think in this one, it feels like a proper alchemy of all of the elements for the first time. The song lengths are both long and also a little bit shorter, which is sort of ironic, because I think that the shortest track length we have on here is still also five minutes and 56 seconds, right?
There is also not three covers. So while I feel like the Americana was very heavy on Kentucky, like the heaviest by far, I feel like that also really helps them to blend into.
This is a far more aggressive record, starting from the very first track, Echoes of a Disharmonic Ever Song, you know? And I think that when you talk about the reinjection of some of that metalcore influence, this is almost the realization of a lot of what Austin was doing on those first three, and I'm going to even say fourth record, even though we call that one Pivot. But, you know, this is really like him finally able to sharpen the blade in a way where all of everything that he's been spinning around actually came out in something that is so palatable and fucking amazing, in my opinion.
Think about that title for a second. The Echoes of a Disharmonic Ever Song.
Evan Song?
Yeah, Evan Song. Either of you ever feel like there's like a theme song that plays in important moments in your life?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I feel like Austin Lunn does. I feel like he lets us know it, that that's the case. This big move he has on various splits, he writes songs about his son, including he has one called Rune's Heart. His youngest son, Rune, has a congenitive heart defect that affects his life that he talks about too.
It's rough.
I feel that. Rune, I got you, bro.
Yeah, I can manage.
Just curious to see if anyone else ever noticed the breadcrumbs that he's leaving here. He's just essentially talking about his life.
I have a congenital heart defect too, Duel. I don't know if you knew that.
I didn't.
Where Mountains Pierce the Sky is phenomenal, but I also want to go ahead and say that this is one of the few instances where we actually see like three monster tracks basically be a part of the same saga. I mean, this is maybe the most... There's probably only one album that I would put up against this in terms of the idea of a concept record. And there are some artists that do concept records great, and there are some of them that come off a little bit cheesy. You know, I would put forth Opeth as being one that can do it really great, and I would say about half of the King Diamond ones to me come off as really contrived. You know, I like the fact that Austin is willing to go ahead and sort of spin both, whereas not everything may have specific themes. I would say that this is one of the first maybe true concept records, because you've talked about how it was written, or I don't know, it was as a part of a coping process in the process of or catalyzed by his leaving Kentucky and moving to where they are currently stationed in northern Minnesota.
I feel like this entire record can actually be summed up in the Long Road, part 1, 2, and 3. And those three songs would actually be long enough for a record. And then Norwegian Nights and Silence Chase the Grain, Echoes of a Dissonant Avian Song, and Where Mountains Pierce the Sky are just like add-ons to the general theme. But the record is the long road, 1, 2, and 3. I think the, or at least the main crux.
I think that that's true. Although, and certainly I would say that the long road part two, Capricious Miles, stands out to me as you know, if I had to pick a favorite one personally from that trilogy, that would be my favorite.
One of the best Panopticon songs ever. And it's not the only one on this record. There are actually three on this album that I would say are some of the finest work Panopticon's ever done, both in title and theme and content. The Sigh of Summer. Well, the warm weather and the fun time's over. Let's get ready to fucking get our shit kicked in for 6 months by the cold brutality of winter, i.e. you just left the warm comforts of home and let's go desolate strange lands of Minnesota.
Middle America.
Something that I want to call out is that this is one of the first times that landscape, like, you know, literally like American geography, plays a role in a heavy role in Panopticon's music, and we're going to see it basically throughout the rest of their catalog.
Yes. Doesn't it make you feel good? Like,
sure, Kentucky, you know, was certainly about labor, and I don't want to gloss over the idea that there wasn't something about, like, you know, the Appalachian-ness of that record. But Roads to the North, you know, it's not roads to Minnesota, it's not roads to the snow. You know, he's talking about, you know, sort of the awe of the landscape. Something that my older brother, who lives in Denver now, told me about the mountains in Colorado is that when he looks at them, he said it feels like he gets the same feeling like when he's looking at the Pacific Ocean, from both of us who were raised on the West Coast. And that was actually a sentiment that I could understand. And, you know, I'm trying to grasp into any sense of basically being small and in awe of the American landscape, because, you know, Manifest Destiny is certainly a part of our identity, if not just through the history of it. But it does kind of manifest it in some ways when, if you've ever driven across country, being very impressed by just the variety of topography that we have here, something that not that they have in every single country. You know, I mean, maybe in Italy, if you go from north to south, or, you know, I think Germany is fairly, you know, diverse as well.
Variety of topography, even in region. I grew up on the Gulf Coast in Alabama, where it's like beach and flat. But if you go to the north of Alabama, you're getting to the Smoky Mountains. His, like, Austin Lund's south is very, very different from my south. But we have a very similar cultural lexicon. But we can all still appreciate the sense of adventure, wonder, and sadness of leaving where you're from into this landscape. Like, I talked about how David Gold of Woods of Ypres takes us to the mountaintop in certain songs. Austin Lund, starting on this record, specializes in taking you, the listener, to the mountaintop. Starting with that song. Also, before we continue on any further, I meant to make that comparison earlier just to get both of your thoughts on it, because I think it's apt. David Gold is another, like, you know, essentially one man black metal project, although he is from Canada and Austin Lund is from the southern United States. And fortunately for Austin Lund, he didn't encounter the same life circumstances that led to the unfortunate end of David Gold.
R.I.P.
indeed. I was curious to get both of your takes, how you would compare David Gold and Woods of Ypres to Austin Lund and Panopticon, because I feel like there's a lot of similarities.
Definitely Lund sucked to more the black metal, whereas Gold, after the first two records, definitely dove more into the
But you remember that David Gold also had, like, the East Ontario Black Metal Preservation Society and other black metal. Like, David Gold was very much a black metal fan.
That's a good point. Woods was his only project. It's important to remember that David Gold is doing a lot more other than Woods, and so he had different outlets. You know, I mean, there was that Korean
Slaughter of Soul. Yeah. Remember it?
You know, the capital, South Korea, which is
fucking sweet.
Love this shit. Yeah,
I hadn't actually considered it. And while you are right that it's both two bands that would be generally described as black metal or black, some form of blackened something.
And one band, they're the ones who say what goes in this project.
I mean, they're both great. I don't really know if they deserve any particular comparison other than kind of just the circumstances of their origin. You know, like, stylistically, they're not really that similar. I love them both.
Really? So you wouldn't think of Woods 2 and 3 similar to Kentucky or Social Disservices
I mean,
at all?
The black metal, and that's where, you know, probably his most blackened record on Woods 3 is like pretty traditional. You know, it's like Dark Funeral-ish, you know, in my opinion, like the ones that are on there. And then when he goes away from it so profoundly where it's almost sort of more typo negative-esque, you know, it's almost, it's really more like, I don't even know how to describe it. You know, I think typo is an apt comparison. So to me, it's not inherently meaningful. I think, you know, it's just sort of interesting to say, like, look at the way that these two groups that were both kind of similar circumstances bore interesting fruit unto themselves. But I don't really think that it, you know, we need to look at like Woods 5 compared to, you know, Autumn Eternal or something like that. You know, to me, that doesn't really mean anything. And that's my point of view on that.
One thing I will say about this record, which to me, I wouldn't necessarily call it a flaw, but to me it stands out, is vocally. He kind of hinted on prior records, but to me his vocalist record, unfortunately, kind of remind me a lot of Tim Lambesis of As I Die. Just to me, that's like kicking out of my head. And again, not a bad thing. It works because he is, the more kind of medical element is there, and it's a better version of his vocals. But in a way, it takes me out of the music. Musically, I love this album. I think start to finish is fantastic. But that vocal style just throws me for a loop. The only negative for the record, for me personally.
Richard, how old are you?
32.
Bob, I'm also 32.
All right, so I'm pretty sure that Austin Lunn is really similar in age to us. We were talking about the metalcore influences, and I think all three of us, for better or worse, I think we all have different metalcore bands that we latch onto, but all three of us unabashedly will claim a metalcore band or two that was vital in our evolution as metalheads. I think Austin Lunn probably would too. I just haven't heard which ones they are, but I think that's why their influences start to come back up starting on this record. I mean, it's not a bad thing. It's not a bad thing because next one that we're about to get to, Autumn Eternal, the metalcore influences actually help make it their crowning achievement as a band. IMO, spoiler alert, I'm about to gush on Autumn Eternal. I think we're all trying to make sure we don't nut at the same time, bro. So, but before we get to that, let's continue on with Rose to the North, because I want to talk a little bit about Norwegian Nights, and I want to talk a little bit about Chase the Grain. One, Norwegian Nights is fun because even Valgeflüster, they, on their split with Panopticon, they did a cover of one of each other's songs and then an original song. And the cover that Valgeflüster chose was Norwegian Nights off this album, Rose to the North. Tell me about Norwegian Nights, what you think about it. Not necessarily Valgeflüster's version, but the original.
I would say it's maybe the most realized sort of soft track in their catalog up to this point, in my opinion. It's absolutely beautiful. I love it. I love it so much. Yes. It, you know, it certainly and undoubtedly would be characterized as a standout from their, you know, typical fare, because it's not heavily bluegrass influence. It's actually just kind of an acoustic track. And, you know, since we've learned a little bit about his Norwegian heritage, it's a little bit clarifying to me to hear you talk about that. So I don't know if this is actually literally a narrative about, you know, a night that he spent when he was potentially learning to brew beer, you know, over in Scandinavia, or something like that.
That's probably accurate. Yes.
But, you know, overall, I mean, my notes here say this is, you know, one of the most resolved acoustic tracks that he's done. One thing that I've said is up to this point, you know, it's felt like he's used his clean vocals a little bit timidly. And I'm actually a very big fan of Austin's vocals. You know, he may not have necessarily a classic, you know, sort of operatic, you know, or typical acoustic delivery or clean delivery, but there's an honesty to his voice. And I'm not trying to cut that down to say that it's appealing to working man sensibilities. But I think about someone like Jimi Hendrix, who maybe didn't have like a perfect vocal, but he made it work for him for everything that he did. And we're going to see a lot more of it going forward. I would say Norwegian Nights is one of the first really great examples in which it's featured.
That's funny to think about, isn't it? When you start to think about popular artists and vocalists, especially like we like think of it from the American point of view, who would say that John Fogerty has a perfect voice?
Exactly.
no one, yeah. but he's unique, and everybody's like, John Gregory, he's fucking Absolutely. Awesome. So I get what you're saying with that. And I feel like Austin actually gets much more comfortable with his mm-hmm. clean voice as yeah, in these next like- few records, judging solely by Scars 2, and then the fact that he put out Scars 2 The Basics, which is literally just guitar and him. Like, it's essentially Nirvana unplugged, Panopticon edition. He stands up when it's just him and the guitar and there's no frills about it. He's a good vocalist. He's just a good musician at this point, dude. He's a good musician songwriter.
I'm quite jealous y'all get a chance to see him live. I unfortunately don't.
After Roads to the North, we come to what one might say the culmination, the mountaintop. I said Austin Lutz specializes in taking you to the mountaintop. In my opinion, 2015's Autumn Eternal is the mountaintop in not only Panopticon's discography, but also in United States black metal. Part of why I think this record is the top of the genre heap is because it incorporates not only United States black metal, not only United States folk music and Americana, but it also incorporates slightly United States metalcore. It also incorporates other forms of United States metal. This record is purely United States, outside of the fact that black metal and metal in general, like, was embedded outside of the United States. Everything else is done from a completely American point of view, and it's done to fucking perfection. I've been doing metal podcasts for close to 10 years, and so I try to think about harshly. Obviously, when I say Morbid Angel's discography is unfuckable, not thinking about the last 25 years, I could be fucking wrong. Sorry, bro. Sometimes I say shit. You know, there are beers involved. I'm sorry. You're right. Morbid Angel's discography is not unfuckable. However, this album is unfuckable, and I'm sorry. If you disagree, we just disagree. But this is not only Panopticon's best record, in my opinion. This is one of the finest metal records ever to be crafted on North American soil. And you would have a hard time convincing me otherwise. The fact that I think Decibel's top 100 metal records of the decade only had this at like number 12. One, I was impressed that he even thought of Panopticon. But secondly, I was also disappointed only that 12. It was only number 12.
But Surgical Steel, though.
I know every single one of us has mentioned this record as being one of our favorites. Donahue, talk to me about Autumn Eternal and why is it one of the finest American metal albums?
I will come on with you 100%. The fact that this record is literally utter perfection. Much like Atramentous Stygian, Worms Forever Glade. Like, there's not a fucking wrong note on this record. Thematically, musically, to me, it's like a movie soundtrack. Like, every song perfectly flows into the next. And big bonus on this record I like is the bass is very high in the mix and noticeable. Yeah. And it has that, the keyboard has that, Ghost Reveries, Opeth yep. production to it. As well as Rose of the North has the same style of production. Like, the keyboards just sound fucking great. And the lyrics, and it's, to me, the best analogy I come up with this is like looking at a classical painting of just a landscape, and you see it come to life in musical form. And it's my favorite modern American black metal record, bar fucking none.
Very rarely that you could sum up an entire album in one song and or one riff, and everyone's like, yeah, I love that record. But I feel like the main riff, the motif for Into the North Woods, sums up this entire record and really this entire band, as far as like, this is why you listen to this band, this is why this band rules, and this is why they do this genre better than anybody.
Yes.
IMO. Bakovich, give us your initial thoughts before we delve into this masterpiece.
Sounds wonderfully. Great. You know, earlier we alluded to what was their black album, and this to me is, I'm going to say it, and it's going to, you know, potentially be patronizing to some people, but their most accessible record, you know, as far as American blackened folkcore goes. So, US
yes, we came BFC.
Can we go blackened American folkcore? Because I feel like American blackened folkcore gets us into dangerous territory.
I love this record, and I talked a little bit about the reverence for nature on the last one, and I think that it takes center stage, Autumn Eternal. You know, it's talking literally about the land almost exclusively, and for me, in some ways, maybe that's where it doesn't resonate as much for me. There's, you know, there's certainly, I don't want to say that that's what it's all about, but in terms of the majesty of it, it certainly paints, as Donahue alluded to a minute ago, a little bit of a landscape sensibility around it, and it's quite... not quite as personal. And so if you're really into pretty shit, which as a huge Opeth fan, I definitely am, but I think that it lacks that little bit of sand, that little bit of grit in there that I think that Roads to the North brought to it for me.
I'm not saying it's wrong.
I'm saying that this is a preference, which is why maybe I don't consider it to be their crowning achievement necessarily.
I think it's very much on purpose, though, coming from Kentucky and Roads to the North, which are very political and very regional
in their
outlook, while this one kind of forsakes the political aspect, and this one kind of goes full geographical. I feel like this was all about the earth. And Austin actually talks about in his interview with Banger TV how he kind of, about this record, Autumn Eternal, switches his focus from American labor movement, leftist anarchy, to more ecological anarchy. The fact that caring for the environment and making sure there's a world for future generations to live in is more important to focus on than the conditions of the workers who are in it. If there's not a world to work in, then it doesn't matter what the working conditions are. I get.
Yeah.
It's essentially where this record starts to pivot. Richard, I think you were in the bathroom when I mentioned that Social Disservices was essentially the elbow pivot.
I got to rebut you here a little bit, Duel, to say that I think that they had moved away from the blatant. They had actually found some nuance between Kentucky and in particular on Roads to the North, where there was introspective. There was, there was some elements of the land, and maybe there was some elements of,
you're right.
I think that there was nuance and kind of beauty blatant. There. And I think that this one, I'm not trying to detract from it at all, but it didn't resonate as much for me, I guess. And maybe it's because of my background in political Bay Area thrash metal. You know, like I liked that element of them, particularly because I had never known about it. And that's what I was so immersed in it. There's really a brazenness that I think is maybe potentially a little bit lost in the really great production, shorter track lengths. Although I say shorter, you know, we only have one that's over 10 minutes here. You know, and we think that even just a few albums ago on Social Disservices, you know, everything was 10 plus, you know, and our final patient was.
If he'd called it Market Street Eternal, Bog would be about it. But apparently Tamarisk Golden Returns is too southern for him.
One thing about this record I do really like as well is you mentioned the Woods of E praying, the similarities, which I kind of see this record, but also to me, guitar wise, it reminds me a lot of like the late 90s, the mid 2000s kind of Catatonia sound guitar wise too, with kind of dissonant down notes that I personally am a big fan of that band. And another record that also kind of has that nature, you know, geographically minded sound would be the death doom band Dusk and their classic of the 90s, Thou Majestic Rule, which in my opinion, top three best death doom records of all time. And this record to me reminded me a lot of that in a much more mellow sense. But the comparison,
I would say, like I certainly said a bunch of things about the record just now. I'd like to dive in and actually talk about how much I actually really fucking love this record. Pale Ghost to me is absolutely fucking phenomenal. It's so uplifting. It's so rich. I mean, Duel, early on you had talked about layers, and I feel like there's no finer example of the way that different soundscapes and everything kind of blend together on that one. You know, there's great riffing. It's actually like, you know, a really nice track in their catalog, which at times can really kind of beat you down. You know, I mean, you have to decide which Panopticon do you want going forward. Do you want the ones that are sort of more sultry, you know, and uplifting because we have a certain amount of those offerings going forward, or do you want that, you know, that fucking fire? It's not all positive. I think one of the tracks that I definitely really identify and resonate with is Oaks Ablaze, because that itself is also an environmental criticism. I think it's also...
Yeah.
Well, as a Californian, you should be used to dog.
Damn. She just got real, but that's why I appreciate Panopticon, right? Duel, if you had any insight as to, I guess, why this one sounds so much better, or if he finally just hooked up with some different folks, because, I mean, it came out, you know, right on the curtails the next year after Roads to the North. There was no gap. And yet, for me, this one does feel like it got a little bit of a boost of production value, for better or for worse.
So while I do not know why this one actually fucking sounds better, if you go to the Encyclopedia Metallum, Roads to the North is listed as Nordvis Productions, while Autumn Eternal, I think, might be the first one listed as Bind Rune Recordings. So while he's always kind of been self-releasing, there was a quote-unquote label change, and I think that is where this happens. He's always kind of been in control of his shit, but this is the first one listed under Bind Rune, which is what he is currently under, which has got a lot of other bands onto it. So I think this is essentially the flagship release, kind of on purpose. It sounds the best. It's recruited a bunch of other people, and it kind of still stands the test of time 7 years on as not only the Panopticon record, but something that kind of draws other people in as this atmosphere of black metal sound.
U.S. black metal perfection.
Nemeris, Necroven, there's a bunch of bands under this label that wouldn't have sounded like this otherwise. Let's put it that way.
Honestly, there's a lot of tracks. You say this record or the best. You all mentioned two of them already. Into the Northwoods and Pale Ghost, but Alpha, we can go on without, you know, at least mentioning the final track, The Wind's Farewell, which is a fucking phenomenal instrumental.
Only one song over 10 minutes. Talk about songwriting growth. They're all just 7 and 8 minutes as opposed to 20 now.
It was to be
character development.
This was the one. It was like, finally, I kissed this in under a fucking hour.
1 hour, 1 minute, 41 seconds.
Slightly over, but still, I cannot, as a hater, I'll be real, a hater of most U.S. black metal. Not this record, though, stands above and beyond as the crowning jewel of the genre as a whole in this fucking country. Any U.S. black metal record ever, you know, this is a very mellow take on it. I cannot recommend Autumn Eternal enough.
I too would agree. This is probably the high watermark of United States black metal, I had to say so off the top of my head. After the release of this record, Panopticon would also go on to release a split with Waldgeflüster. And then they would also put out a album called Revisions of the Past, which would be a re-recording of Social Disservices and On the Subject of Mortality, which is curious because On the Subject of Mortality itself was also a recompilation of songs that were featured on various splits previously in the podcast, that we would talk about those albums again later, because while they are the same songs, they have been re-recorded. They do sound different, and for some they are better and for some they are not. For me, I much prefer the Revisions of the Past versions of all of these songs. I love this record. Absolutely love this record. If you wouldn't have told me that they were just compilations of previous songs re-recorded, I would say it's one of their best albums. But as is, it's one of their best compilations of songs that they have recorded. Let's put it that way. If that's not an album, of course it is, but metalheads would probably have something to say about that.
If I'm correct, sir, the band can't notes correctly, because I read the I listened to the originals as well as The Ridge of the Past, and Colin Marston, I believe, remastered these, who plays in Dysrhythmia, and also played with Luke LeBay and Gore Guts, and did a fantastic job. I'll be honest, because I'm the old school demo motherfucker, I do kind of prefer the originals with all the imperfections, but these new versions do sound a lot better. If we're newer fans, probably would have liked these version more, but I kind of like the old school version.
Bogrovich, your thoughts on these remasters?
I don't have a particular affiliation for cult recording, so I'm a big fan of these. I think back to the Waldgeflüster re-recording their entire first record, and honestly, it's kind of one of the trepidations that I have about trying to lay down some of my own material. It's maybe just like that perfectionist inside of me that, you know, doesn't want to, I guess, subject my art to less than ideal conditions, and so I can always appreciate
art.
I can really appreciate having the ability to go ahead and do this, and also actually putting forth the effort, because I mean, a track like Resident wasn't easy to record, and so to do it again, you know, that's a feat into itself. So I really applaud it, and I'm a big fan.
I love the title, Revisions of the Past. Again, we've talked about this maybe a little on the nose. You don't have to be subtle. I don't care. Let me know.
These sound great. They sound better than the ones who already sounded good, but I think these are the best versions of the songs.
For some people, yes. I did want to add that these were sampled. So what happened was they had the drums were redone by a guy named Spencer Morris using samples to capture the original, and Colin Marston did remaster it. So it was a collaborative effort between both of them, the three, them and Austin Lund. And they did come beautifully, for sure. I just kind of like the originals because it's kind of the person I am. I like that nasty, raw demo shitter, the less than perfect production. Hell, I'm an Immolation fan, and their production switches from genre, album to album. And that being said, the songs are so good, it shines through even when the production's lacking, which is probably an understatement. But with certain bands, that's just the case.
Panopticon would go back into the studio for a few years to record what would be their most ambitious album yet. Talking about The Scars of Man on the Once Nameless Wilderness, parts 1 and 2. So Panopticon, as we've discussed, is not only known for being an awesome and United States black metal band, but they really put the American United States in that U.S. black metal category, using a lot of Americana and United States folk music interspersed into not only black metal tracks, but sometimes giving them their own tracks altogether. Well, for The Scars of Man, part 1 of 2, Austin Lund decided to go with an entirely black metal album and an entirely Americana folk album, which you could argue is the ultimate version of Panopticon, and quite possibly not only the most ambitious, but the most realized version of Panopticon as far as what they've been trying to do throughout their career and what came out right then and there. If you've been listening to the Fundamentalist podcast since 2018, you'll remember that The Scars of Man on the Once Nameless Wilderness Part 1 was my album of the year in 2018 when it came out. It was the first album of the year list for the Fundamentalist podcast, and it was the top. Gentlemen, give me your thoughts on this record. Why is it fucking awesome? And have you heard the Redux, Scars 2, The Basics? Let's start with the first one, though. Bogrovich.
There is an atmosphere to this record that has been sort of amplified, and I think that it is an expansion on the idea of the wilderness. The Scars of Man on a Once Nameless Wilderness being the title certainly indicates that it's a look on deforestation and the destruction of the environment, and some of the Native American imagery on the album covers, as well as the dubs inside of these tracks, hint to the fact that this is kind of about the destruction of the earth. And there's a somber tone to this record overall, while compositionally not wildly different from Autumn Eternal. It's maybe a heavier listen, in my opinion, because you don't get nearly as many uplifting moments, I would say. And that's what kind of characterizes this separate from it previously. And I'd also like to point out that there's a 3-year difference between when this one came out previously. And so it will be the longest gap to this date between records, although this is a double, a whopping total of 18 tracks. So he certainly had a lot to lay down at this now excellent recording quality that he's releasing records at this point. Some of the stands out, track number 2, Ein Heit for Abends Dodd, which actually translates to the death of a white raven in Norwegian.
That's it. You stole it.
Another track that I think is really phenomenal, and also kind of a great metaphor for a lot of the topics that he's covering, is Snowbird and Branches, which is the closer of the first track.
Yes.
One of their best songs.
It's absolutely phenomenal. Yes, but it encompasses that sort of somber quality, because while it is quite beautiful, there's a depressive quality to it. You know, this is actually like a very, this is kind of a rough listen. And I don't say that because it's maybe one of their most beautiful records, but it's so impactful for me. Like, I think that the riffs are used so deliberately, and to me, it elevates it to be kind of one of their best, maybe the best of what I would call sort of this sort of environmental introspective era of this band so far. And, you know, I don't want to gloss over the, you know, we call it sort of the folk. It's not as folky as I think I would characterize it. It's an acoustic sort of soft record, although there's a lot. There are equal parts kind of electric musicians, music as much as there is, you know, some banjo and some kind of more folk influenced stuff. And I think that it's been really fun to see, as I mentioned earlier, Austin's clean vocals really kind of come into their own and become like such a great and enjoyable feature on that second record.
Yeah, Scars 2 is very much a production. It's just a cleaner production as opposed to being straight up black metal. I wouldn't even call it 100% folk or bluegrass or even country, because there is a lot of electric guitar and there's a lot of production in there. It's just very soft, much softer, and those elements are much more prevalent, but not 100% in either of those directions.
This may be an obvious reference point, but in a way, it reminds a bit of Opeth Damnation in a way. Softer, very emotional, but similar vibe to Damnation. They're both double records.
This album is also really interesting for the fact that we talked about how Austin had previous experience living in Norway, and for the first time in a couple records he's got tracks in Norwegian. If he had done that earlier in the career, and now on this record there are three songs with Norwegian titles: Ein Vith Ravens Dot, Death of the Right Raven. I'm sorry if I butchered that, Norwegian listeners, which Bakrovich already mentioned. And then there's En General Avsky, which translates to a general disgust. And then there's also Blotsamen, which means blue hour. And it refers to the special coloring of the sky during the twilight period after sunset, but before the onset of nighttime darkness. While the sun is approximately 4 and 8 degrees below the horizon. This song was written in honor of Valfar from Vindir.
Died in a snowstorm going to his parents' cabin.
Yes, yes.
Cold as fuck.
Yes, so talk about highly specific. That is the most, it's a tribute to a fallen metal brother, quote unquote, but also the most specific cult reference you could ever be. Between 4 and 8 degrees in the night sky to the left. Not to me. Also, before this record, like I said, Austin Lund has said many times, don't listen to his albums on shitty speakers. He says, please don't listen to this album on your laptop speakers. It will sound like shit. Give it a shot on a long hike or by a fire with headphones. The first half of the album is atmospheric. The second half is more Americana focused. So beware if you hate country folk. The Wandering Ghost is for Adam Nicholson, and it's in memory of Guy Clark. Austin Lund leaves people that he is influenced by to kind of tell you what the song is about via their vocal samples. And on Snow Burden Branches, he has a sample from world-renowned environmentalist Sigurd Olsen. And you hear him from the quote, a great many people, young people, come to see me and they ask me, what is your hope for the world? And I always answer them that the hope for the world is in you.
It's very real. No, it touches part of you beyond whatever political beliefs or ideology or whatever you feel about the world. It touches you in your core of your being. Just the human part, like you were saying earlier, all this political shit doesn't matter. If there's not a planet to do it on, it doesn't fucking matter either way, no matter what side aisle you're on. So it gave me goosebumps several times listening to the track and album as a whole.
Funny, Bakrovich, Donahue, do you have anything to say about Scars of Man of the What's Name of This Wilderness Part 1?
I liked her quite a lot. It seems like they took a... It's still very well produced. They took, I would say, almost an old school soft production to it, though still being well produced at it. And in my opinion, I feel that tracks 2 and 3 do blend together a little bit, not by much, but if you're not paying attention, you could, they could seemingly blend. But from track 4 on, I feel this record really takes off, and it may be one of their best records as a whole. Even though it's mostly metal, there's still bluegrass, there are a little folky, softer spots in it. But I think it's great. If you want like just a purely aggressive side of the band, I would definitely say start with this record. If you just what you want for this band, this would be the record to listen to.
Ranks 2A for me. 2A.
It's phenomenal. I always appreciate when an artist wants to release something as a double album, because we, in this culture of music, are moving so far away from the idea of any tome of statement or artistry that actually requires some time to be digested. You know, even movies are getting shorter, and you know they're becoming sort of more.
The Batman calls nearly 3 hours in. Let's say otherwise.
Well, okay. Not all of them. But in terms of digestibility, I can always respect when somebody, rather than parse out, as we've said, the David X style constant engagement of you know, ideology to fan engagement, to release something like a double record, and especially one that has, you know, as much character as this one does, especially with Scars 2 being, you know, a stylistic departure from a lot of what Panopticon had done up to this point. I think that it's also nice to see an artist feel like they have enough, I don't want to say leeway, or like the ability to do so. He didn't have to worry about scaring away his cult constituents by releasing a lot of clean and pretty tracks. You know, I have a note here that The Itch is probably the most radio friendly track that Panopticon ever put out. You know,
TBF, between 2007 and I guess 2018 when this record came out, he tried to alienate the cult crowd a lot. So if they're still around, they're not getting scared away.
That's fantastic, because what it's making is some of the best music that Austin had ever made, in my opinion. And that's kind of what I have to say about that, is in some ways this is, you know, this and Autumn Eternal are while you know, they are thematically different records, I think that they are some of the most pure expressions of Austin Lund's visions and music up to this point.
I feel like Autumn Eternal is apolitical, while the Scars of Man on the Once Nameless Wilderness, parts 1 and 2, you can kind of almost tell with the title are very environmental in their perspective. He very much has a point of view, as opposed to like what we're doing to the world, as opposed to Autumn Eternal is more like remarking at the beauty of the world, just kind of Autumn, observing, as opposed to like, fuck, we're,
if you wanted to look at it
up,
as
guys,
a metaphor, though, Autumn Eternal could be all of the earth dying, you know, essentially everything in fucking death perpetually too, you know. So I'm gonna say that it depends on how much you want to read into it, because I actually wouldn't say that Autumn Eternal is apolitical, especially if you look at Oaks Ablaze too, you know. But I think that it's definitely certainly more pronounced on the Scars of Man. They literally are talking about mankind's you know, influence on the destruction of the planet that we live. So
I guess the more accurate way I could present that statement, because I think you're right, is that it's the most apolitical Panopticon record, because I'm not sure there is a entirely apolitical Panopticon.
Austin would never do us like that. He's not going to take a powder. He's going to make sure that he's saying something for all the effort that he puts in.
I would hope so. Goddamn. Prolific's a goddamn understatement.
So let's move on to Scars 2. It's very interesting in the sense that it's almost a rock record. It's like a very produced rock record almost. And I don't mean like it's softer in the sense it's not a black metal record, but it's not so stripped down that it's an acoustic record like Scars 2, The Basics. Once again, reiterating Austin Lund's proclivity for fucking making sure you get exactly what he's saying. He revises things that he feels like should be revised. And I feel like the fact that he stripped down Scars 2 to the point of just vocals and acoustic guitar is important, because maybe he didn't get to his point the original way Scars 2 was put together.
Honestly, my thoughts on Scars 2 is I enjoy the record quite a bit, you know, the softer side of it. And I kind of felt some of the songs could have, I don't know, a couple of 2 minutes or so off certain tracks would have been made a bit more stronger, but I did enjoy it overall. I didn't hate it, but I didn't necessarily love it either. Like, it was a different side of it. I didn't appreciate it, but I felt a few of the songs, they could have been short a bit. They would have had more impact, but I did enjoy it quite a bit, but just to me, it didn't do much. It was there. I enjoyed it. I moved on.
Bog, I know you're itching to get to our top 10 and into the last record. give us your quick thoughts on Scars 2.
Scars 2 is a great record. We had compared it to Damnation simply because it's a metal band that, you know, later in their catalog decides to release something that is wholly clean and acoustic. I will say that I didn't find Scars 2 to be nearly as compelling as Damnation, and, you know, whatever that comparison is worth, you know,
yeah,
whatever.
100%.
But some of the tracks that I did, you know, really appreciate were Across Abandoned, I think is certainly a potent, you know, anti-religious sentiment in that. And then also Not Much Will Change When I'm Gone really speaks to kind of the humility that I think he were made to feel through the majesty and largeness and environmental soundscape in basically Autumn Eternal as well as Scars 1. I think that he was sort of vocalizing that. As I mentioned before, I loved Austin's vocals, you know, being explored and coming into their own in many ways on this record. And I think it was a completely valid and totally worthwhile offering to listen to. So give it into that. I didn't listen to the Scars 2 Basic, but it's kind of fascinating that he went back simply with an acoustic guitar because maybe he felt like he was betraying the soul of the music. You know, I like to think, especially after that quote where he said to go ahead and listen to something around a campfire, that that's probably the environment in which many of these were scribed for the first time, and maybe he wanted to give something that was a little bit more authentic to that experience. So it's just, you know, you know, again, we look at Metallica, they could barely put out a record every 4 years, and Austin is continually trying to you know, flood us with another take on something that was already a valiant effort to begin with is very commendable, and I think it's pretty cool.
I try not to think of Austin Lund as that douche around the party with the acoustic guitar playing "Come All You Coal Miners" at the fucking party. You're trying to get laid. He's singing to you about class struggle. Funny to think about. Let's go ahead and get into the most recent record, and again, Into the Light. We already talked about this
episode podcast. 85. Go back and listen to it.
Singles. Yeah.
Yeah. Check it out, yes. Motherfuckers.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. Let's not talk about it too much because we still have to get to our top 10. So it made my honorable mentions for last year. I absolutely fucking loved it. Once again, I'm struggling to think of anything else that I haven't already said about the album other than what Austin Lund already said about it. It's about trying to find some semblance of peace and light in a very dark and seemingly insurmountable wave of darkness that is in the world today. I guess you could say that about a lot of Panopticon records, but their certain political viewpoint kind of made it seem like there was a way to fight it back from it. While, and again, Into the Light kind of makes it seem like there's nothing to fight against. Like, you just get pummeled, and you either come out of it with a sense of positivity or you just get swallowed whole. And I feel like that's kind of the point of this record. That's how I took it anyway. Yeah.
To me, it seems more accepting. Like, you know, like say you have the path on the road, you take A or B, and that's your path. There's really no coming back from that path. And going back to my thoughts on the record, I want to say my thoughts haven't changed. I would honestly say my thoughts are a bit diminished on this record, especially here in their whole discography. Like, it is very good that the dynamics are there. There are a few tracks I like, Rope, Exit, Burn, and Moth-Eat Soul, I enjoy a lot more. And though there's this particular denseness to this record that the other records don't have, that kind of throws you for a loop. Me and Pete were talking before the podcast started about how the production always seemed, for the most part, go to upwards trajectory. This one, it kind of went backwards a bit, and it went denser, but I wouldn't necessarily call it the densest good. It, I would say, kind of holds back the dynamism of the record, personally. Dynamism.
Oh, man. I feel like the layers really add to this record. Have you ever seen Shrek? Panopticon, ogres, onions. They got layers, Doc.
I'd slap you if you were fucking next to me. Will Smith style.
Ogres have layers.
I'm going to start this one with that audio sample now. I will say that there is a different sound and feeling, whereas I think everything had incrementally kind of gone forward. This one actually in some ways went back to, it kind of imbued the sorrow of Scars 1 with maybe kind of more the aggressiveness of maybe like Roads to the North, or maybe even like Social Disservices. There is kind of a thicker fuzz quality, and I wonder if maybe like Austin got a different, you know, amp or something, you know, or he put pickups in his guitar that were different than the ones he was using before. Cause there's just, there's something just like slightly different about it.
If he's a guitar player, you know he is. I mean, no guitar player's ever like, this is it. I'm never changing anything.
Well, I mean,
ever,
you know,
no guitar player ever.
It is a pretty sorrowful record. And there's kind of a little bit of like post-metal atmosphere here. It does differ slightly from sort of maybe more of the jazzy atmospheric interludes, and that it maybe is a little bit more oppressive. Like overall, this is, you know, a rough listen by design, I imagine. And, you know, you talked about thematically, it's about sort of more acceptance or, you know, maybe sort of grappling with sort of the eventuality of some of this stuff, whereas potentially previously it was sort of more advocacy based. That's all speculation. I would like to say that No Hope, and that's K-N-O-W, Hope, the final track on the record, to me is an amazing track, totally a standout. It's definitely worth listening through, you know, everything basically just to get to the final half of that one itself. Moth-Eaten Soul is also pretty phenomenal. But all in all, you know, this wasn't Scars of Man 1, in my opinion. But it also was on my top 10 albums of 2021, too. I think it was number 8. So I'm certainly not trying to hate on it at all.
Wait, quick question. What year was it that the Sepultura record was your number 1?
I thought Wayfarer was my number 1. I thought Quadra was 2. I think that White Stones was 3.
Modern Sepultura. Top 3.
It's not the Sepultura love that bothered me. It was the Panopticon hate during the review.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah, it was like, I like it, but caveat.
It gets a 2 out of 5, and then it shows up on like number 6 of this year-end records list. Like, what? All right. So we've just gone through 9 Panopticon records, and there are singles, splits, and EPs that we could have continued to go into. However,
but we didn't.
We really just don't have fucking time, man. Fuck. We only have time to give you our top 10 tracks from Panopticon. We distilled 9 albums, splits, singles, all into 10 tracks a piece. If you had to listen to 10 songs from the band, this is what you would do. And this is why this band is fucking great. Donahue. Give me your top 10 with a quickness.
All right. My honorable mention will be Rope Burn Exit from Again Into the Light. Top 10. Number 10, we have Patient from Social Service, the final track, the crown jewel of the record. And number 9, we have Bodies Under the Fall off of Kentucky, the second track, a phenomenal opening metal track, quote unquote. Coming at number 8, I feel underrated track on the album, In Silence, off Roads to the North. At number 7, we have a track we discussed earlier, Snow, Bird, and Branches off Scars 1, a simply fucking phenomenal track. At number 6, we have A Superior Lament. At number 5, I have to say the melody in this track is fucking infectious. It is my favorite track off the record as a whole. That would be The Singing Wilderness off of Scars 1. Number 4, Sleep to the Sounds of the Waves Crashing off Autumn Eternal. At number 4. Number 3, Where the Mountains Pierce the Sky, off Roads to the North. Number 2, The Wind's Farewell, off Autumn Eternal. And finally, Numero Uno, Pale Ghosts, also off Autumn Eternal. So what about you, Peter? What's your top 10?
I will say ahead of time that I have deliberately decided to omit any track that is largely a clean track from this list. This is my top 10 metal tracks from Panopticon.
Oh, weak, sir.
That was the criteria in which I decided to do it. I felt the same way when I reviewed the Dillinger Escape Plan, because this is a metal podcast. So my honorable mention, I'm going to shout out Norwegian Nights, which is my favorite clean track that they do off of the triumphant 2014 Roads to the North. Getting to my top 10, I have Killing the Giants as They Sleep off of Kentucky. Number 9, I have Einheit Ravensdod off of The Scars of Man on a Once Unnamed Wilderness, which again translates to a white raven's death. Number 8, I have The Long Road Part 2, Capricious Miles off of Road to the North, which is really, really great kind of the jewel of that trio of tracks, which makes up at least half of that record. Number 7, I have Oaks Ablaze off of Autumn Eternal, one of maybe their most environmentally focused tracks off of one of the most majestic releases that they ever created. Number 6, I don't share this placement in common, but I also am a big fan of In Silence at number 6 off of Roads to the North. Underrated yes, track. It's also man. Some of the heaviest material I think that they've ever put out. That record really does synthesize a lot of the beauty, but also some of the rawest material as well. At number 5, I have Snow Burden Branches off of Scars 1. I already talked about my affection for this track, so I won't labor it, but the sample in there is quite chilling and certainly sets a certain mood to listen to the rest of the phenomenal guitar playing on that one. Number 4, I have Resident off of Social Disservices, shouting back to one of their early and very important yes. records. I said that this one was a little bit emperor-ish, and you guys rolled your eyes at me, but I stand by that statement. There is a layering and cacophonous quality to this song that should not be overlooked, and really considering that it's about a quarter of that record, is totally worth listening to. Getting into my top 3, at number 3 I have Pale Ghosts off of Autumn Eternal. Phenomenal record, one of their most uplifting tracks, Opeth-ish, layered, it's absolute triumph. Number 2, to sort of sharpen their most political pencil that they ever decided to scribe a track with, I have Black Soot and Red Blood off of Kentucky. Basically, the largest political statement that they ever made about that subject genre. And my number 1 track, maybe a glaring omission considering how much I doted upon it before, but at number 1 I have Where Mountains Pierce the Sky off of Roads to the North. Is absolute absolute sublime bliss in audio form, and it should be listened to immediately right now by anybody who has never heard it before.
So for me, my top 10 for Panopticon, starting off with my honorable mentions, I have I Hedonist from the self-titled debut. I also have Resident and In the Valley of the Shadow of Death, which can be found on various albums, but my favorite versions can be found on Revisions of the Past. Also, I have Hakan's Song, which is found on the Panopticon and Waldgefuster split, talking about his oldest son. Going into my top 10, their cover of Come All Ye Coal Miners from Kentucky. Listen to it. Do it. At number 9, I've got Killing the Giants as They Sleep. Coming yes. in at number 8, I have Moth Eaten Soul from And Again Into the Light. Number 7, I do have Snowbird and Branches. I think this is the only track that all three yes. of us have on our top 10 in common because it's fucking awesome. All hail Sigurd Olsen. Coming in at number 6, I also have The Long Road, but I have The Long Road Part 3 as opposed to The Long Road Part 2. The Sigh of Summer spoke more to me. Absolutely fucking loved it. And actually, I was incorrect when I said this is the only song that's shared amongst all our three, I think. So at number 5, I have Envit's Raven's Dode, which Bogrovich and I have. Richard did not. Almost the second song we all three had in common. Coming in at number 4, I have A Message to the Missionary, that sample from The Seventh Seal. Really fucking slaps hard for me. Fucking love it. Coming in at number 3 is a song that I'm really fucking disappointed that none of us really talked about, because this is a black metal band. Panopticon, first and foremost. Black metal, right? No one's like, I want a fucking black metal track. That's called Chase the Grain from the End of Roads to the North, an album that Bogrovich talked about he fucking loved. And I'm stunned.
In Silence, dude, is heavy too. That's the one that I prefer. Like, that's, I totally hear you, but
I feel like Chase the Grain, like, could have come straight out of Norway. You, like, Kentucky, fucking what? Americana, what is this? Like, you would have thought this band was from Norway if you just heard Chase the Grain.
If it was for those weak ass guest vocals near the end, I would have put it on here. Those weak ass guest vocals near the end totally threw it off for me personally.
Oh my God, get out of here. Coming in at number 2, also from Roads to the North, where
we all three have that one on our list. It's actually in all of our top 3s, yes. too, right? Mine is 1. Richard, yours is 3.
Oh, so perfect. 1, 2, and 3. There we go.
Yeah.
And I'm really disappointed none of y'all even had this in your top 10 or honorable mention. It's my number 1, Into the North Woods. The main riff, the motif. You know how much Finsternish shit I've ripped off from that riff? More than I care to admit, darn it.
Don't admit that. You're drunk, dude. Shut the fuck up.
That's actually true. Somehow that's true. All right. We have somehow made it through Under the Knife, Panopticon. 9 albums. Holy shit. I have to admit, I'm very proud of the selections that I've made. I've gotten us through Dissection, Emperor, and Panopticon. And honestly, if we never did another Under the Knife again, and also I picked Woods of Ypres. I also did Woods of Ypres. These 4, I don't think I could pick any bands outside of At the Gates, which was almost
I've done
that
Corner,
I would want to do.
Death, Dan Lilker, and Dillinger. That's a pretty respectable offering too.
That's pretty fucking solid. That's pretty solid. It's pretty solid.
So I've done Typo, Nevermore. I saw two to go, you fuckers. Y'all at 408, goddamn two.
You did join late. You joined the podcast asshole later, though. Like, I.
Fine. Next. I'm up next, motherfuckers. No more cheating and fucking lying like the beast I should have been.
You did join late. But I want to say there was like, and like all together, we all agreed we just had to do this. Because Coroner.
For sure. No.
Like Coroner and Candlemass were like, all right, we all agree we're just going to do this.
That was pre-you.
You were on Dissection. You joined when we were doing Dissection.
Yes, for sure.
You joined during Dissection. And then we had, after Dissection, we did Death, what?
Emperor, Nevermore.
And then Emperor. And then Typo, Nevermore. Dan Loker, which was a feat.
Four grindcore records in one day, I don't recommend it. I'll make you want to blow your fucking brains out. Don't fucking do it, kids.
Hey, bro.
It's,
but you got to hear
it's our highest listened to
asshole
episode ever.
It beat Typo. I'm very jealous.
It's Comrade Loker listening to it.
I hope
it
so,
himself.
Man. That would be such an honor.
Thank you all for listening to the Fundamentalist Podcast, this deep dive, this under the knife panopticon. If you have any questions for us at the podcast, maybe you have a fact check for us or something you want to add, or you have some hate mail like some of these other cunts do. The Fundamentalist Podcast, you can find us there on Facebook and Instagram, as well as the Fundamentalist Podcast at gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. Peter Bogg, thanks for being here on the show, brother. I miss you over there in New Orleans. I hope you drink a few beers for me at the LGBTQ Easter
I'll do my
parade
best.
Right now. And
the best one.
Donahue, I miss you as well, brother. And I hope you drink some booze up there in Boston.
Boston, Massachusetts,
and all those places. Yeah,
driving my car, Harbor, drinking a fucking beer. Yeah, motherfucker.
In that area of the country, indeed.
All right, I'm Peter Bogg.
I'm Dual Guest.
Richard Donahue,
and this has been the Fundamentalist Podcast Panopticon. Thank you for listening, and we hope you tune in again next time.
Go fuck yourself.
I heard a story you wrote this when you were pissed drunk. Blah, 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 blah. I don't know, bro. Like, get fucked.
Yeah.